Kevin Garnett is a Hall of Famer, and we debate the best season in Boston Celtics history, 08 or 86. It's the Monday Locked On Celtics. Millie's, let's go! Rainer J's back with the vengeance, back all the real Celtics fans in attendance. This the truth like 34. This like walking in the garden when you hear the roars. The crowd goes crazy. Most in-depth coverage on the daily, mainly podcast royalty, the content kings. When you talking about the franchise with 17 rings, focus like Danny at the deadline. Global, but it got a local feel like the red line, the blue line, the green line. Play it in between time. I'ma throw my C's jersey on in the meantime and press play. When the F's done, I can't wait until the next day. Trying to stay in tune with the C's, it's the best way. Melly. Monday, the quote-unquote work week for those of you still working. Hope you are. Hope you're getting through this crazy period well enough. I know it's a little crazy, but hope everybody's getting through it. So, I'm John Corrales of MassLive.com. Still talking basketball Monday through Friday. And even as news kind of dries up, there's not really much going on, but we're still going to be talking about a lot of different things this week. Remember, Tuesday through Friday, we continue our historical deep dives. Last week, if you missed last week's podcast, any of them, we did the 50s. Birth of the Celtics, all the way up until their first championship, first two championships, actually. And then this week, we dive into the beginning of the dynasty, the real, like, meat of the Boston Celtics dynasty in the 1960s. For now, today, we're leaving Mondays open for our wild cards. We're going to talk about the greatest greatest single season in franchise history. And to do that with me is Chuck McKenney of RedsArmy.com. Chuck, how you doing?
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, I'm sure it is.
Nowhere else I'd rather be. Well, there's nowhere else I can be, so no.
It's literally your only choice.
Yeah.
But before we get to the greatest season in history, we have to acknowledge Kevin Garnett, who was elected officially to the Hall of Fame. Enshrinement is still scheduled for September. We'll see if the situation in the United States allows for that. I hope it does. I hope somehow we can figure something out, because he goes in with one of the, if not the greatest Hall of Fame class ever, with Tim Duncan, with Kobe Bryant, with Tamika Catchings, and then coaches like Eddie Sutton and Rudy Tomjanovich. I mean, it really is just an awesome, awesome Hall of Fame class. But we're obviously going to focus on KG for a few minutes here. And I think we can immediately, Chuck, kick this off into one of our nominees for one of the greatest seasons in Celtics history, which would be the 2008 team, the first year KG was here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that team was, to put it politely, trash before he got here.
A little bit.
it was just a rough couple years, and it's just remarkable to think that's when you and I thought that it was a good idea to start blogging about the Celtics, but that all worked out for
isn't that crazy? Well, was it 2006 we did that?
Something like that.
Yeah. So they went 33-49, and then they embarked on a season where they were at 24-58. In the midst of all of that, a combined 57 wins in 2 years, we were like, hey, let's start a blog.
But it paid off rather quickly. So, for me, Garnett was, you know, I mean, I was a fan of his before he came to Boston. I appreciated him for his skills. He was a bit loud for my taste, but, once he came to Boston, and you could just see, and everyone talks about this, he really, I mean, everyone says he changed the culture. But it's 100% fact that he did, and you could just watch him lead. And I know there were a million different pieces that had to gel, egos that had to be set aside, and Doc was the right coach at the right time. But to me, that was Garnett's team for the next few years, and I just had a new appreciation for him and his skill and his leadership, and it was just. he just escalated up through the, you know, obviously that championship season, they were amazing, but he really rose through the ranks of my favorite Celtics in the relatively short time he was here, just in the way that he played. Man, it sounds cliche, but he really put it all out there. He was just he was just so tough and gritty. And he had the greatest sound bites.
Oh, I mean, man.
You think of all the things he gave us, you know, just the grit and balls stuff. And he would throw these cooking analogies out there. He was just so fun. You know, the Superman press conference when he started humming. Right? There's just a million different, you know, between that and his play and his leadership. Like, I don't know how you couldn't just fall completely in love with the guy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He just had everything.
Yeah, he totally did. This is where I remind people and cop to the run-up to the trade for Kevin Garnett in 2007. The summer of 2007, I was like, we're giving up too much for this guy. I don't care how good he is. You know, we're giving up way, way, way too much. And, you know, I thought at the time, I was like, well, you're taking away the entire bench. At that point, the trade, I mean – whatever, I'm not going to rehash all of it, but I was very high on Al Jefferson. I thought, hey, look, Al Jefferson, we've already got a guy that could be the future, you know, star forward. Like, let's let this kid develop. And then, so I wrote a bunch of things, and I was like, I'm opposed to this trade. And then, literally, I didn't even have to see him on the floor. Like, as soon as they had that news conference where him and Paul and Ray all were there with their jerseys up, I was like, oh, yep, I was wrong. Totally wrong. Like the instant he showed up and held up his jersey, I knew right there that I every justification that I have for that trade, I didn't even have to wait for it to happen on the court. I didn't have to wait to hear him talk. The instant I saw it, I was like, yeah, okay, this was a good move. He just has this energy. When you talk about the culture change, The thing that Doc Rivers always said about KG is when your star player buys in, it's easier for everyone else to buy in. And that's what KG did. KG came in and bought everything that Doc was selling. Doc Rivers came up with this thing called Ubuntu, and KG was like, yes, 100%, I'm all in. And then that force, and he's such a force of nature that everyone just kind of falls in line behind him. And so if he told Doc to, you know, buzz off, like, yeah, now we're going to do things my way. They were going to do things however Kevin Garnett wanted him to do things. And luckily for the Boston Celtics, that Kevin Garnett was just the right guy at the right time. And what makes that 2018 so great is that he and Ray and Paul were like the perfect, almost perfect, like, When KG said over the weekend, like, I wish we'd gotten together a couple of years earlier, like, that would have only been the only way to make it more perfect. But the almost perfect combination of age, experience, as far as having gone through playoff losses, like, before KG got to Boston, all he had was one off season. One postseason, I should say, where they had done anything past the first round. He got to the Western Conference Finals once. Everything else was first-round exits. Ray Allen, same thing. Paul had obviously gone through the same stuff. So, like, having those guys go through, like, all of their losses, all of everything, coming here to Boston and saying, hey, we're willing to sacrifice, that was as big a key to 2008 happening as anything. And obviously KG is like the most unselfish star you've ever seen.
Yeah. I mean, I was just looking through his stats, and he had some really good shooting seasons his first 3 years in Boston, obviously because he was playing with two other great offensive players. I just can't, that image of him just stepping into like a 18 footer and just knocking it down repeatedly. That was his shot. Mm-hmm. But he sacrificed some offense, and I think he gladly did that. But on defense, he was the alpha, right? It's almost as if they had an alpha on offense, they had an alpha on defense. So he was the man, and it was obvious he was the leader of that team. And I don't, you know, like you talked about, you know, Paul was just, you know, he had already, you know, been kind of partners with Antoine, you know, several years before. I think Paul, you know, kind of knew what it took to kind of sacrifice a bit. So I don't think he had a problem with it. And plus, he had suffered for so long. He was like, thank God these guys are here. You know, finally some help. But there's just so much else to Garnett that really just made him so much fun. The knuckle push-ups or the barking, and you know, that's the kind of stuff that if you're not, you know, a fan of if he's not playing for someone else, you find it annoying. Right, there was that 2009 playoff series, I think, when he was injured against Chicago. That awesome series, and that could have been the first round. And Garnett was on the bench for that for a few games.
Yeah.
Constantly barking and yapping, the kind of stuff that if you look at, you know, another player, you're like, oh, what a
he's a right.
Right. You know that guy.
Right.
But when he's on your team,
oh, I love it.
Just like, you know, just going at guys and slapping the floor. And that it just was so uplifting because, and I think part of it was, you know, like we talked about, we had kind of suffered for so long for a handful of years, even going further back, just to see really reinvigorated this franchise and this fan base. And that team was awesome. They kicked ass from start to finish.
Yeah.
I mean, we might talk about that more later, but KG swooped in and they all just kind of, they clicked and they were kicking ass. And that just, and it all kind of, you know, we saw how awesome shooter Ray was and Paul was doing his thing and Garnett. I mean, he was defensive player of the year that year.
Yeah.
Some people thought he should have been MVP. So he was all doing his thing, but he just had this city by the balls, really, right? Yeah. We just all fell in love with him. But he knew it. The love was right back. He would always give it back to the fans. So for me, that's why I couldn't help but fall for him. And then there's no doubt in my mind that his number deserves to be raised up with the others, six seasons or not. You know,
yeah.
He was a central figure in that, you know, and obviously in that championship. And then that there was like, you know, 4 years where they were formidable. And he was just really the key figure there.
Yeah. There was some kind of discussion when it was first announced, like, oh, my God, you know, 6 years in Boston, like that's what gets you your number retired. Like I get that maybe Boston has too many numbers retired. I'm not going to argue that either. But Kevin Garnett, just, again, going back to the whole culture change, the way things turned around, I feel like, and this sounds cliche, but like I feel like that attitude kind of still permeates the team. Like the part of the whole thing with Red and the stuff that we talked about last week on the podcast and that we're going to continue to talk about this upcoming week, because I think in the 60s, it really took hold. Celtic pride is a palpable thing. That's a thing that Red Auerbach talked about. Like, he specifically tried to foster and build a thing called Celtic pride. And I think it kind of went away for a while. In those 90s, in the Rick Pitino years, like all of that, that just kind of, it dipped, it waned, it's kind of gone. And then Kevin Garnett comes in and boom, Celtics pride is back. And I think it's still here. Like that arrival, that impact that he had on the team really brought the entire franchise back to like its roots. And I think that's still something that he, you know, you can still feel that today.
You know what? That's a great point, and I agree with you 100%, because so much time had lapsed from the 80s that, you know, the 90s were such a laughing stock for the Celtics. Then we had a little taste of, well, we might have some young players we can build around in the early 2000s. But then they fell flat again. So you're right. That's sort of Celtics lore, that the whole winning tradition was so distant. But the moment that team won again and then started to be contenders, It's almost as though, you know, the weight from all those other teams comes back. Like, you feel it again. It's that swagger. And it's like, it's not just the swagger of, well, we just won a title last year. It's like, we're the Celtics. We're a badass franchise. Right? So everybody feels it. The fans feed off of it.
Yep.
I agree with you. That's absolutely. And I think that'll, you know, and so that little run between with that team kind of, you know, propels us into this sort of next, you know, this next era. Right. So when Tatum and Brown are doing their thing, it'll just be another transition.
Yep.
But it's absolutely true, because we went so far. I mean, the franchise fell so far that it was tough to kind of fall back on that. Yep. And we really lost it.
Yep. Rick Pitino stole it. Kevin Garnett brought it back. I think my last thing here with Kevin Garnett, I think to make it really special, to really make that number retirement appropriate, as he's raising the banner, they have to play the Geno time video.
Geno, I forgot about Geno.
Because, as I've said a million times, I wish I loved anything as much as Kevin Garnett loved Geno time.
Like, he made Geno. Without KG's infatuation with it, then there's no Geno.
Yes. Yes. I mean, every single time it came on, it was like the first time that he saw it. I mean, you get a new guy. You got Rasheed Wallace on the team. First time they play, he's like, look at this. And they blew so many teams out that they got to play it so often. And he just loved it. Every single time, it was his favorite thing in the world. Like that, somehow, Geno time, if they don't play the Geno time thing as his number is going up, I'm going to be pissed. I'm going to talk to some people and see if I can make that happen.
That's a great point. I forgot about Geno.
All right. So when we come back, we'll start our conversation about the greatest season in Celtics history. Now, if you follow me on masslive.com, you may have read that we had a conference call with Enes Kanter on Friday, and I kind of like what he had to say about his hiatus. He said, you know, we're all busy. We had an opportunity, you know, this is almost an opportunity to, you know, we're stuck inside. Let's educate ourselves. Let's learn new things. Let's try new things. And he's, you know, cooking and playing piano. Another thing you could do is read a book, a self-help book, something like that. But even if you don't have time, or even if you want to maybe cram a few in, you could use the Blinkist app to solve that problem of not having enough time, so you can work on your own personal development. Blinkist is really unique, and it works on your phone, your tablet, the web. It takes the best key takeaways, all the need-to-know stuff from thousands of nonfiction books. It condenses them down to just 15 minutes, so you can read and listen to it all quickly. Successful people like Enes Kanter, like Brad Stevens, a lot of people who are in power are well known for reading a lot of books. Blinkist is made for busy people like us. We want to take the main points of a book away quickly, so you can start using that information right away. And with its audio feature, Blinkist makes it easy to finish a book during your commute, if you still have one, or whatever it is, a lunch break while you exercise. 12 million people are using Blinkist right now, and it has a massive and growing library from self-help, business, health, to history books. Blinkist has the latest titles from bestseller lists, as well as classic nonfiction titles that you always meant to read but never had time to. With Blinkist, you can get unlimited access to read or listen to a massive library of condensed nonfiction books, all the books you want, for one low price. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for you and this audience. Go to Blinkist.com/NBA. Try it free for 7 days and save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist, BLINKIST, Blinkist.com/NBA to start your 7-day free trial. You'll also save 25% off, but only when you sign up at Blinkist.com/NBA.
You are Locked On Celtics, your daily Boston Celtics podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
So the entire Locked On Podcast Network, on the basketball side anyway, is doing these specials this week on the greatest, the best season in franchise history. We're going to do it today, just today. But if you want to go to other franchises, if you're curious to see what the Lakers people say, go check out Locked On Lakers or the Knicks or whatever. If you're just curious, go check them out. It's something fun to do across the network. Since we're doing our whole history thing throughout the rest of the next 5 or 6 weeks, we're going to just leave it to today to do the best season in franchise history. Chuck, I've come up with 4 nominees. You tell me if you have another one, but I'm going to go in chronological order, okay?
Cool.
1957, it's Boston's first title. They won 61% of their games. They didn't play as many games as they do now. In fact, in 1957, they were 49-23. It's a 72-game schedule. They had Bob Cousy as the MVP. Tommy Heinsohn was the rookie of the year. They drafted some guy named Bill Russell. Casey Jones was in that draft. So this is Casey, Tommy, and Bill Russell were all rookies that year, and it was Boston's first title. So that's my first nominee. My second nominee is 1969. It's Bill Russell's last title. What makes this great is that's the balloon game where Bill Russell is now player coach. It's his last. It's his 11th ring. He's only lost twice in the playoffs to this point. They're the underdogs. They go into L.A. and they beat the Lakers. He sees the balloons up in the rafters, and he says basically, I forget what the exact quote is, but something like, those fucking balloons are staying up there, and they did. So that, I think, is just a great season because it's the end of Bill Russell's career, and he goes out on top. Then the two obvious ones, I think. 1986, Boston wins 67 wins. It's one shy of the team record. They lose only 3 times in the playoffs. They only lose 1 game all year at home. Bird wins his 3rd straight MVP. He's the finals MVP. Bill Walton is the 6th man of the year. That is perhaps the greatest team assembled in NBA history. It's in the team picture at the very least. And then 2008, 66 wins, 2 shy of the team record. It's Boston's first title since that 1986 team. You've got Pierce as the finals MVP. You've got KG as the defensive player of the year. Like we just talked about earlier, the return of Celtics pride. Those are my 4 nominees. Do you have any others?
Well, I mean, so I think it's tough for me to really look at the teams from the late 50s and 60s. It's all a blur to me. You know, obviously I didn't watch them live, but so I would just have to look at sort of statistics to see.
Sure.
You know, who, you know, maybe where, like which one of those teams won the most games in the regular season and had the fewest playoff losses. So that could be done, but it would still be, you know, strictly off of numbers and not the eye test, which I think is important. So
sure.
I'm not going to contest you there. I mean, and I think the Celtics have a lot of championship teams. So you mentioned how the 86 Celtics and their 67 wins, that was the second most in franchise history. That naturally piqued my curiosity to see which team had the most wins. And it was the 72-73 Celtics who won 68. But they lost in the Eastern Conference Finals. So they clearly don't make the cut for this discussion. I guess I would throw out the fact that you should have the 84 Celtics maybe in the discussion. I know it was very similar. The big difference between the 84 and the 86 team was Maxwell and Walton, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they had a little bit of, you know, there was a little bit of the differences there. And that 84 Celtics team beat the Lakers. So,
yep.
That
always gives you that little extra oomph.
Just a little bit. Yeah,
the Lakers.
And I'll never slight the 86 Celtics because it was that Rockets team that beat the Lakers.
Right.
So I just might maybe throw in the 84
sure.
Celtics somewhere in the because Bird was still, you know, I mean, that was the first of his 3 straight MVPs. So the big three was kicking ass then, too. So I might interject them,
sure.
But I can't really, it's tough to argue with the group you've selected.
Yeah. I mean, I threw in those others kind of like just as a nod to the history. Like I can't really make an argument, a strong argument for the 1957 Celtics. I mean, yeah. Again, because, you know, we didn't see it. I didn't see it, but again, you know, it's a different era back then. There's you got 30 teams today. They had eight teams then. But that did mean that there was a little bit more consolidation of talent. I mean, there's, you know, more teams had more good players. But also 1957, we're talking about a league that's still not fully integrated. So you still have a division of talent. So it's hard to really make like a strong argument, but it's an important year, as we said on the Wednesday episode last week, where we talked about that draft. I mean, obviously it's the most important draft in Celtics history because you get Tommy and Russell and Casey Jones, and those are three key elements to future success. But you know, we in this discussion, right, we can kind of throw them out. The 69 team is a fun story, but you know, Russell's on his last legs. They beat the Lakers, which is, you know, fun, but that team, they went 48-34. They were kind of like the underdog that season. They were fourth in the Eastern Division. At that point, there was divisions, not conferences. They were fourth. They
were like the 2010 Celtics, but they won.
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah. So really, when we're splitting hairs there, I think like 84, you can throw 84 into the mix, but the real decision comes between 2008 and 86. And I feel like I know where we're leaning, but let's just try to figure out, like, maybe as we talk this out, maybe we come to some sort of like surprise here, because the league in 2008 is different than the league in 1986. Style of play is different. I mean, you've got, they still had to beat the Lakers with the MVP, Kobe Bryant. LeBron is still is in the mix. Dwight Howard is at kind of like the height of his powers. And there's a lot of competition. This is your, you know, your full 30 team NBA that you have to get through. So I mean, the 2008 team still had like a lot of pitfalls, and for them to kind of blow through everybody, I think is impressive.
You know, and I've had I lost my train of thought there. We've seen. ESPN has aired the championship finals, or is it ABC or ESPN? Yeah. I think I've seen the 2008 finals. They showed game six, you know, within the past week or two. And I've even, maybe it was Comcast that showed the, it was the 1986 game six, where the Celtics beat. So it was interesting to see the styles of play there. You know, and like you said, even back in 2008, the floor wasn't quite as spaced as it is now. So it was a different game back then than it is today. But it's important to note that I wanted to look at that 08 team and say that team defensively was the better of the two teams.
Sure.
But then when you look at the stats, that Celtics team had that number one defensive rating.
It did.
The 85-86 Boston Celtics were first.
They were. But their defensive rating was 102.6. So you have 102.6 points per 100 possessions. The 08 Celtics gave up 98.9 points per 100 possessions, which is just a stupidly good number. Like, that number is so insane. That 2008 team was just a crusher defensively. The 86 team was just worlds ahead offensively. And they could play defense. I just wonder, it's hard to compare these eras. I wonder if, you know, under 2008 kind of rules, or if the 2008 team played in 86, like they had hand checking in 86. What if you could play that 08 team back in 86, just time machine them over there and have hand checking rules? Like, what would they'd give up like 88 points, never mind 90, like 88 points per 100 possessions. Like that defensive team, hey, I remember, like they had KG and Perk, and Perk at that point was just basically like an impressionable young kid that took to KG's teachings and was like his muscle, like his backup, like a bouncer for the bouncer. You know what I mean? Like that team was just stellar defensively. I think that matters.
Of course. And you had Rondo, right? He was young, but he was playing some defense back.
That's what he tried playing defense. Yes.
Right. So, and a big part of that 08 team was their bench. Yeah. Posey was huge.
Yeah.
And he was a great two-way player, right? So he was your 3-and-D guy back in 2008. His job was to make some threes and play defense.
Right.
But when you look at how, you know, that 86 Celtics team really only played seven guys from what, you know, it was just that elite starting five, and then they went Walton and Siegstein. And those are the only guys I saw play meaningful minutes in that, you know, conclude the
right
elimination game, game six in 1986. And you look at that bench, that's who they went with. Now, when you have such a great starting five, you know, do you really need a bench?
Right.
But that's the 08 Celtics. They went a little bit deeper. They had a few more specialists. We had Eddie House. We had Leon Poe. We had PJ Brown coming off the bench. So there was just a better mix of the bench in 08.
Right.
But I don't know if that matters when you're talking about which team was better. It's just, to me, it's an obvious difference between the two.
Right, right. I mean, so this team is like great. This 08 team is one of the best defensive teams in Celtics history. But if you put 2008 versus 1996 and you had them play each other, like who guards Bird? does Paul Pierce get to check Bird?
Probably.
I love Paul, but that's not going to go well. That's not going to go well at all. I trust DJ guarding Rondo. I mean, Rondo is going to do his thing, but DJ is one of the best defensive guards of all time. Danny Ainge was underrated, I think, as a defender and would piss Ray Allen off. I mean, yeah,
that's a great point. He would irritate.
He would get Ray Allen to throw a punch. Like he would irritate him to no end. KG on Kevin McHale would be just, oh my God. That matchup would be
dynamite.
Oh, yeah. My God. Just thinking about it. That's a matchup I wish I could see. Like KG against – oh, my God. and then Perk against Parrish. Like I think the – obviously Parrish was a really good defensive center and a really good offensive center. He had like a good face-up game. He could actually pull Perk away from the basket, and that would really be – I think that's kind of where things begin to unravel for the 08 team, is that Parrish could pull Perk away from the basket and you lose a little bit of that rim protection. And then Bird just does Bird things. And I would give the edge to the 86 team.
Yeah. I mean, I would too. I think Bird's the best player, generally the best player. If the teams are close, the best player finds a way to pull it out. And I had a renewed appreciation for Legend's passing. You know, I obviously consider him one of the top five players in the league, but you know, when you watch, you know, basketball back in 1986, very few players were playing were standing outside the 3-point line. No one was considered a threat. Everybody was packed in.
Yeah.
So there's really not a lot of room to move the ball. And to see the way Bird found the seams and still connected on those passes when players weren't being guarded so far out, I was like, wow, there's no room. How's he getting the ball through there?
Yeah.
Because now when you watch, you know, players have to guard 25 feet from the hoop. They didn't have to do that back then. They were all sagging off. It just was a much tighter court. And it just gave me a new appreciation for Bird's ability to pass the ball. And that Celtics team liked to run too.
Yeah.
And, you know, they weren't Showtime, but when you compare them to what the, I don't know what the fast break points, if you were to dig up some stats, but I would think if out of those two teams, 08 and 86, you know, that 86 Celtics team liked to run. They would, you know, they would push the ball when they could. And that was Bill Walton's last big hurrah. He was still pretty formidable and not just as a scorer and a rebounder, but he could move the ball too, right? It's just so much fun to watch that team move the ball around. So, I mean, I'm with you. I would pick the 86 Celtics team against any team.
Yeah.
Whether it's the 08 Celtics or whomever you're putting up against. But I think that the 08 Celtics are right there. I think they deserve that second spot in the on the franchise list.
Yeah. So the 2008 Celtics second best season in Celtics history. Let's take a break and come back. I'll give you the actual pace numbers when we come back and support Chuck's argument here of how much the 1986 Celtics like to run.
Follow us on our social channels at LO Celtics on Twitter and at Locked On Celtics on Instagram.
I'll read off this stat here, pace. People kind of mistake like pace as when you see the pace number, it makes you feel like the team is more up-tempo. That's not necessarily the case. So pace is the estimated number of possessions per 48 minutes. And the theory is the bigger the number, obviously you're getting more shots, you're running a little bit more. And that's a little bit true, but there are a lot of factors that go into it. But anyway, the number, the Celtics pace is 101.2 possessions per 48 minutes, where the Celtics were 90.9 possessions per 48 minutes. And so the 08 Celtics were definitely more of a, I think, slower, grinded out team. You also got to remember, like in 1986, you had Larry Bird at 29, Kevin McHale at 28. These guys are mostly young in their prime. DJ is 31, Parrish is 32, which is about the age, I think, when Kevin Garnett got to Boston, he was how old? 31. So, mm-hmm. Like, Ray Allen was 32. Pierce was 30. So, those guys are a little bit older. So, they're kind of like on the tail end. So, this 86 team is guys who are right smack in the middle of their prime, mostly. Like we said before, Larry Bird is in the third year of three straight MVPs. Three straight MVPs.
Larry His numbers Bird. Were ridiculous, man. His numbers were ridiculous. Sorry to interrupt.
No, that's exactly what I was going to do. So Larry Bird in 86 averaged just under 26 points per game, 9.8 rebounds, 6.8 assists, two steals, by the way, two steals, and shot 49.6% from the field. Larry Bird, a wing, shot almost 50% from the field, all right? Shot 42.3% from three and only took 2.4 threes per game. Can you imagine that Larry Bird in this era with looser rules? You can't touch the guy. The emphasis on the three, which he was just a phenomenal three-point shooter, I can't begin to imagine like what kind of numbers he would put up in today's era. It was just insane.
He was a 50-40-90 guy. If you round up, he was a 50-40-90 guy who averaged seven assists and got you double digit boards. I mean, he's LeBron, but he's just a better shooter. That's what he is. it's truly the difference when you compare these two teams. And he only played 38 minutes a game. So I don't know. Maybe that wasn't enough.
What my favorite Larry Bird stat is that he made 3 all defense teams. That's to me is like, you'd never think of Larry Bird as a defender. He made 3 second team all defensive teams.
No, you're right. Just to see that the two steals jump out on the stat sheet, he was just savvy enough, and his IQ was through the charts. Everyone knows it. So his ability to anticipate whatever he didn't have physically, and you watch him the first 5 years, he could move. You know, you're not going to mistake him for, like I said, LeBron James, but he could still move, and he was just smart. Man, he was just smart. He knew where to be, and. I think the proof is there. 2 steals a game is a pretty damn good number.
Yeah. So what made the 86 team just great? I think part of what made the 86 team great, and this is going to step on the 1980s talk at some point, but I'll be happy to reiterate these points in a few weeks. So 86 is coming off of that 85 finals, and for people who haven't paid attention to that era, 85 is Magic Johnson, the hook shot, the win, the Lakers winning in Boston. That's right there. Like in, I think it was 84. Was 84 when Red Auerbach, the Celtics beat the Lakers in 84. The trophy presentations in the Celtics locker room. Red Auerbach grabs it and says, "Everybody's talking about the Lakers dynasty. This is the dynasty right here." And he's pointing. That's the Celtics kind of steal that one. The Lakers come back in 85 and win, and then so you've got this motivation, and Larry Bird is pissed because he lost to Magic and he lost to the Lakers. They add Bill Walton in 86. They went out, I believe this is Seasting's first season with the Boston Celtics. So they went out and got him 85-86 is his first thing because he was in Indiana. So they got Seasting to bolster the bench. And like you said before, they really kind of went 7 deep. So you have Seasting backing up Dennis Johnson. Is this DJ's? When did DJ get to Boston? He got to Boston in 84. So he'd been there for a couple of years. The addition off the bench, especially of Walton, was huge. The bolstering their bench made all the difference in the world. To see Larry Bird dump the ball in to Bill Walton and then cut, and Walton would just make these amazing passes, hitting cutters back door, no look passes, kind of like flicking them over his head. I mean, that kind of stuff is what made this 86 team great.
You know, I took a quick look at the assist numbers for the teams. This 86 team had 29 assists per game.
That's insane.
That's ridiculous, right? They had three guys.
Monster number.
They had 3 guys averaging more than 5 assists per game. You know, the 07, the 08 Celtics, I think they averaged 22.5 assists per game, and only had 1 guy more than 5 assists. I mean, that's proof of the ball movement in 86. And I thought my eyes, you know, my eyes knew it because I'd seen enough of those games. But then when you look at the numbers, you're like, holy shit, 29 assists per game. That's obscene. Man, I don't know what the stats are for the averaging of most assists per game. Maybe some of those Western Conference teams in the 80s surpassed it. But that leads into why that Celtics team was they were number 3 offensively that year. They just moved the ball. And yeah. Not only do they have great shooters, but they move the ball around.
it's wild to look at those old games. And it's great if you have the opportunity when they're rebroadcast now. If you haven't seen it, go ahead. Really, honestly, one of the things that stood out to me nowadays, they were making entry passes into the post that nowadays they'd never make. you know, like Bird would have a guy in the post and DJ would be on the right wing, and there'd be a guy kind of like in between them, like a little off to the side, and DJ would loop this high pass way over, so Bird would have to kind of reach up and grab it with his left hand. Like, you'd never make that entry pass nowadays.
No, you'd be benched for that.
Right. So much of the game back then was predicated on post play. And not only did they have McHale, who's the ultimate master of the low post, Larry Bird took guys in the post, Walton took guys in the post, Parrish took guys in the post. All of these guys not only could work guys in the post, they all passed. Well, not all. Kevin McHale never passed out of the post. Larry, all of them except McHale, would pass out of the post. And, you know, when I'm sitting here, like, watching a game or tweeting or talking about it, you might see it on Twitter. How many times have I said, like, when Marcus is in the post, like, when Marcus is posting up, cut behind him because he'll find you. Like, when we had Al Horford in Boston, I was screaming, get it to Al Horford in the post and cut behind him so he can find you. Al Horford would have been a god in 1986, an absolute god, because he could play in that post and pass out of that post and score. Like, he's already going to be a Hall of Famer, I think, but like, he would have been in some all-time conversations back then. And that's the way these guys play. If you watch these, just watching them get the ball in the post, and because I think maybe because everything was so kind of jam-packed, it was so easy to just like step in, and you're so compelled to double those guys in the post that as soon as you made a move as a defender to double those guys in the post, that's when the cuts would happen and they would burn you.
Yeah. That's an interesting point. You know, I was just thinking about the coaches, right? You know, those sort of intangibles for each of these teams.
Yeah.
And this Celtics team had Casey Jones, who he was there in 83 or 82. He came after Fitch, right? I should have looked this up while you were talking. But I'm lazy. He was there for the 84, 85, 86 when they went to the finals. The Celtics went to the finals three straight years. And then I think he was there in 87. It was 88 that Jimmy Rogers took over. So Casey Jones against Doc Rivers, I think I often had the impression, and I think a lot of folks thought that Bird was like that coach on the floor.
Sure.
Bird was like that guy in the huddle who's, you know, give me the damn ball, get the hell out of the way, right, sort of thing. He made it easier for Casey Jones. So I don't know if that's a knock on KC, but when you look at the two coaches, do you have any sort of sense of who may have had an advantage?
I would call it even. And the reason I call it even is because you hear these guys talk about their coaches, and I just saw it maybe like a night or two ago, all of these guys talking about Casey, they loved Casey Jones.
Yeah.
Part of why they loved Casey Jones is because he played just like Doc played. And he was a champion. He was a Celtic. Like, he had Red Auerbach's blessing. Like, he was there. Like, he had been part of the franchise's, like, the fabric of the franchise. I said it last week. Casey Jones as a player was basically Marcus Smart before Marcus Smart. Just intense, defensive-minded, get up in people's faces, piss them off, really just be a bulldog out there. And him as a coach, you hear these guys talk about it, like, he was kind of like, I'll let you guys kind of handle it, but if you ever get out of line, like, he was the guy that would, whenever he got pissed, everybody was like, oh, whoa, wait a minute. Casey never gets pissed.
He was very stoic on the sidelines. You're right. Yep, for the most part.
The thing that stands out to me, and it was part of that 86 run, Robert Parrish So they're playing the Milwaukee Bucks in the Eastern Conference Finals, I believe. Yes, Eastern Conference Finals, Milwaukee Bucks. And at that point, Don Nelson is the coach. Don Nelson's a former Celtic. His number's retired. Don Nelson is trying to pump up his team. And so he's trash talking. And he trash talked Casey Jones. He called Casey Jones overrated. And he started like really like kind of bad mouthing Casey Jones. And Robert Parrish says, I was pissed. I'm still pissed. Like thinking about it. Like even in the documentary, he's like, just talking about it now pisses me off. It's like, that's the only series. That's the only time that I ever played pissed off. He was pissed because the other team's coach was bad-mouthing Casey Jones. That's how much he loved Casey Jones. And by the way, the Celtics swept the Bucks in those finals. And Robert Parrish, I'll look up the stats of the series. Robert Parrish went off, I believe, in that. Let me see here. He had a good series. I'll just put it that way.
Well, just to play off that, right? I mean, I think the problem with Fitch was not a lot of players liked him. And Mike Diamond might be able to speak more to this.
Bird loves Bill Fitch. Bill Fitch.
Now? But did he love him then? I just remember there being some sort of friction with Fitch and either the players or Red, because that team won a championship in 81. Yeah.
Well, he quit because the owner sold the team. He quit over, like, the owner sold the team, and so I forget who bought it, but he quit because the team was sold, and he protested that, and he quit. So that's why he left.
Ah, okay. So that's it's a little Celtics lesson for me. That must have been when the Gastons took over.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And the Gastons were assholes, so I can understand why Fitch.
Yeah. So
okay, so, yeah. Interesting.
But Bird, like, Bill Fitch was just inducted into the Hall of Fame last year, and Larry Bird presented him, and he was just like nothing but adoring of what Bill Fitch did as a coach. So, but anyway, going back to your original point, I think Casey Jones, like, Doc Rivers was a master motivator. The money in the ceiling at the Staples Center was, you know, a brilliant move. The Ubuntu thing was a brilliant move. Like the, cause he understood, like, you have to, the only way they were going to work is by the totality of their team. There wasn't going to be one guy. Like, you had three individuals in Pierce, Ray, and KG coming in, and his biggest fear seemed to be like, are these guys going to jockey for a position of being the alpha? I've got to hit them with team. And, you know, that message resonated, and it, because it worked with KG, like I said before, it worked for the team. But that was a brilliant maneuver for him. Like, he didn't just kowtow to a star. His whole thing was being tough and preaching team, and that's really what got the 08 team to kind of gel very quickly.
Yeah, you know, that's a great point. I think earlier when I was talking about Garnett and the way the big three kind of fit together, they just happened to be good complementary pieces. By explaining it that way, it really undersells what Doc's role was. And you're absolutely right. He deserves a lot of credit for setting that tone at the beginning, and really, you know, forcing them all to buy in. So that's a good
and
point.
And also remember the Doc Rivers, Paul Pierce thing. Like, they Pierce was almost like asking to be traded, and then he and Doc sat down and they worked it out. Like, Doc working through that stuff with Paul was huge.
Yeah, and Doc was kind of on the hot seat, right? I mean, there was a lot of fire Doc stuff going on leading up until that season. So it's not like he was. He had the you know, he had the collateral to make any bold moves, so that was that was some wild times.
Remember, we had a guy who called himself Fire Doc on our on Red's Army.
Yes, I remember. the heart attack part of that 08 team was the playoff. I mean, they went to seven games against the Hawks.
Yes.
They went to seven games with LeBron's Cavs, and then they went to six with the Pistons. With the Pistons, it was a little bit easier, right?
Well, they couldn't win on the road.
They could never win on the road. So, yeah. And they were such a dominant team all year. And that was a little bit unwavering at first. But when you compare it to the 86 Celtics, they steamrolled through. Yeah. They lost one game before the finals.
Right.
They didn't screw around.
Right.
I think not that the 08 Celtics deliberately did, but
I would say that Atlanta series is a fair amount of screwing around. In it, I think there was a little bit of the Atlanta flu that was going on. Atlanta's got some great strip clubs. I think they were partaking a little bit in that. But I do remember that 08 team were like, why can't they win on the road? Like they, it wasn't until that Detroit series where they finally win a road game. We're like, oh, okay, here we go. But even then, like they had that huge comeback against the Lakers. That was, if they didn't come, what was that, game four?
Yep.
They had that huge comeback. Like, oh my God. Like you're sitting there like thinking like this team is supposed to be so good. Why can't they figure it out? But like the Celtics, they had no, like you said, none of those problems. That 08 team was just dominant. They tore through the Bucks. They have Atlanta, Chicago. They just marched and sat there waiting for the Rockets and Lakers to figure things out. And then Ralph Sampson hits that stupid tip shot, and you're like, oh.
That ruined that robbed us of another moment, because the Celtics team would have rolled over that Lakers
right,
team.
Right.
And but that just robbed us of one more victory over LA.
That's such a Celtics thing to like. You're right. I totally agree with you. but it's such a like. Oh, I wanted to beat the Lakers.
Yeah.
Like, it didn't matter. Like, so it's such a like. I'm sure like Hawks fans are like, come on, really.
Winning isn't good enough. You have to determine. Right. You have to figure. You know, it's sweeter if you beat somebody else.
Right. Yeah, I'm glad we won, but Hawks fans sitting there like, we haven't won since the team was in St. Louis, but that's okay. You guys go ahead and have your fun.
Oh man, that's great.
So, officially crowning the 1986 Celtics as the greatest season in franchise history. I mean, there's so much to talk about in the 86 season. We'll save it for the 80s podcast because, I mean, there's like, they gave up beer. Like that was supposed to be a thing where they gave up drinking. Like that's the 80s. That's the 80s in a nutshell. Like, you know, we need something to rally around. Let's give up drinking after games. And people were pissed about it.
Well, I'm pretty sure Rasheed Wallace had a few less Bud Lights after the after games in 2010. The Celtics might have pulled out Game 7.
They might have for sure. That might have been a good thing for them to do in 2010. Yeah. Oh God. All right. Well, this was fun. So tomorrow, Tuesday through Friday, it's the 60s. We're going through the 60s. So if you haven't subscribe to the show yet, please do. If you haven't listened to last week's shows, go back and listen Tuesday through Friday, because we start on Tuesday with the birth of the Boston Celtics, Walter Brown hiring Red Auerbach. Red Auerbach was almost the next great Duke basketball coach and not the next great Celtics basketball coach. The Bob Cousy story, how they twice tried to pass on Bob Cousy, twice. So that's in those series of podcasts. The 56 draft, which got the Celtics Bill Russell, Tommy Hines, and Casey Jones. All of that stuff is all last week. This week, the 60s, the birth of Celtics-Lakers rivalry. Sam Jones, the most underrated, I think, most underrated star in Celtics history. He gets into the mix and how he was not happy about coming to the Boston Celtics at first. And then history with Bill Russell. Bill Russell's time as a civil rights icon, an important part of Celtics history there. And then Bill Russell becomes the first black head coach in NBA history, winning titles as a player coach. All of that stuff going to be discussed all week long. So subscribe, give a 5-star rating, give a good written review, share the podcast, tell everybody, listen to the Locked On Celtics podcast here on the Locked On Podcast Network.